back to Classical Guitar Insider. I'm excited to be back. I'm actually smiling, tearing up a little bit. It's been like 4 months. Any longer, it would have been half a year. Today on the show is Lubos Nabersteck. Lubos Nabersteck. I think I'm saying it right. Let's look him up. I was gone for a while I do this. I can't really talk and type at the same time. Let's see what happens. I'm not connected to the internet. Anyway, it is. It's Lubos Nabersteck. Lubos Nabersteck. And he is a luthier who lives in New Jersey. He's originally from Prague, Czechoslovakia. And he has a fascinating story about taking off from there before the wall came down and after the revolution. So he has a fascinating story. I'm starting out with him. I interviewed a couple of other people, and it was great. I was at the Manus Festival, but the problem was it was a very international festival. So I actually had to... There were some language barriers with the other two interviews that I've gotten so far out of that. And it was... I have to take a look at them and make sure that everything works. I mean, a lot of it is great, and I think we want to hear from everybody, right? So, but... I just want to make sure that everybody's represented well and take a look at it. Anyway, so I was gone for a while. But before that, let's just say the show is sponsored by SavageClassical.com, S-A-V-A-G-E, Classical.com. You can go there and you can get a guitar. He's still in Bay Shore, New York. He can send it to you. You can try it out. Return it for free. That's SavageClassical.com, S-A-V-A-G-E, Classical.com. Richard Sage will get you set up there. All right? The show also sponsored by the Manus Guitar Symposium. Am I right about that? It's not a festival. We can't just call it a festival, can we? You got to call it something fancy. That's important. Let's make sure. Manus Guitar Seminar. I believe at one point it was called a symposium. Maybe I'm right. Wrong. Okay, so it's the Manus Guitar Seminar. I got you, Sam. I'm getting texts, too. And that is the sponsor of the show as well. The seminar, you know, every year during the early part of the summer, they host a number of international artists. And then they also throw a couple of local kids the bone. And it's a real good time. And there's no... competition element to it, which I always like. I think it's neat. And in Michael Newman and Laura Altman's episode, they talk about how that comes at a cost for them. That comes at the cost of higher enrollment, because, you know, these things are resume builders for people. So they, you know, these competitions, so that you get more people that way. But they don't want to do it. They don't want to do it because they're good people. I'm not saying that the people who have the competitions are bad people. You people are great. You people. I think it's a brave decision. And I think that a festival without a competition is something kind of refreshing. It's a music festival. It's a place for people to perform and people to listen. So they sponsored the show as well, and they put us up in, you know, great rooms with great sound, and, you know, Michael and Laura always make me feel very welcome there. So I was gone for a while, and I was at a charter school in the Bronx. As you know, if you listen to the show, if you're new to the show, I see that there's a lot more people than ever listening, which it fascinates me, the fact that I've been gone for 4 months. That's great. If you're new to the show, I this year became a public school teaching assistant at a charter school in the Bronx, and it was an incredibly challenging job. It basically put everything, including this, on hold, or at least slowed down anything creatively I was doing. It pretty much put the guitar to a complete halt. And then the person that I was working for went on pregnancy leave, the teacher who I was assisting in the Bronx. And she left. They trained somebody. This somebody lasted 3 days and quit for good reason. And the place just, it's chaotic. So I, I end up with the job as teacher, as salaried employee. It's the first time I've ever had a salary. The first thing I did was take a day off. I had to take a day off or something, and I got paid to take the day. It's the first time that's ever happened to me in my entire life. I forget what it was for. It was for something. I think it was for a wedding or something. I was like, I got to take a couple of days at the end of the week. I look at my paycheck. It's completely the same as if I was there. Is that what's going on? Is that what you guys do? You guys get paid time off. What a luxury. I felt like an adult. Until I was actually working. Then I felt like I was having my face pushed into an old, dirty rug. I'm sorry. I hope that I think I've earned. I stayed there the entire year. I did my job well enough for you guys to, you know, make me a teacher. I don't have certification. I got along with the kids. And I got to tell you, sometimes those kids were hard to get along with. Now, I think that I stayed there a year, so I think I deserve to say what I want on this show. And also, if you listen, and I know that a lot of you do, and I know some of the kids listen too, so I might cool it on the cussing for the next couple episodes until they get bored. They won't listen to this forever. They'll listen to this one maybe. Just to see what's up with Mr. Brett there. Well, Mr. Brett quit. Mr. Brett quit because you guys could not stay in your seats and you guys could not be quiet and listen to me teach. That's essentially what happened. Now, I don't know if I'm supposed to tell you guys that. And I know that you're listening because you told me you would and you've listened before. And, I'm getting the, I don't know if you guys can hear that. The texts are coming in. I'm going to turn off the texts and let's go ahead and, I turned it all off. So why is this on? Why is messages on? I don't know. Okay. I don't want to text people right now. As you can see, I haven't done this for a while, but you know, people, I know I'm not supposed to tell you guys this. I know it's nothing's your fault and everything like that, but you're big kids. You're in seventh grade. Stay in your seats. Don't get out of your seats and shut up. If I can only teach for 5 minutes and then the entire class goes bananas and gets completely out of control, guess what? I'm gonna not come back next year. I hope everybody else is getting a taste of my teaching technique. I didn't say shut up. Did I ever say shut up? Maybe I did. I mean, it got to the point. I mean, it was like we were in the weeds there. Now, there were many, I would say, not the vast majority, but the majority of you guys were wonderful. And all of you, I love. I love every single one of the kids I taught. It doesn't matter whether they were difficult or not. They were still children, and it's that still that light that is in children was able to shine through. There's no such thing as a bad kid or a, there were kids that were ready to learn, and there were kids who maybe just weren't ready to, you know, God bless them, learn how to play the bucket drum or the guitar or, you know, about quarter notes. It just wasn't on their radar. Can't blame them for that. I consider that a administrative oversight. Listen to me. But the point is that, kids, if you want teachers who you love and who love you, you got to stay in your seats. I mean, there were some of you guys that would literally leave the classroom and I couldn't get you back in. It took me 15 to 20 minutes just to get you guys in the class. And if you want to know, if you weren't there, let me tell you what happened, kids. The choir, If you're in choir and you sang, thank you very much. But I'm about to tell the audience what happened. So this is what happened. The choir. This was like lights out for me. Now, I loved the kids individually. One-on-one, each one of them was a beautiful person, and I would not trade what I did for anything. It was a wonderful experience. But I think the kids got to take a little responsibility. I think the reckoning is here, and I'm going to use this podcast episode as a way to make sure that you guys learn one final lesson from Mr. Big Diaper Brett. This is what you need to know. I know that you liked me. I know that you liked me. I like you. But you got to make sure that your teachers can teach. If your teachers can't teach what they're there to teach, they won't be there that long. Unless they're just there to teach. They're not really interested in any particular subject. I have to tell you, I'm a musician first and a teacher second. At least that's what I've tried to do. But I'm a person with feelings. And when you spend an hour on a lesson plan and you go in there and nobody wants to do it because three kids decide it's stupid, it's heartbreaking, kids. Anyway, let me tell you what happened. The choir concert 2 weeks ago, June 30th, the last hurrah, was a field day. A field day is a day where the kids... It's the last day of school. They get to go outside. We're outside the whole time. I took a couple of kids out to play some board games in the back. It was super fun. And then, not any fault of mine or the kids, we were told that we were going to do a concert that day. So some of the parents were there expecting a concert. Me and the other teacher, Alex, had... They didn't tell us where to perform. We kept on asking. Nobody knew. Nobody cared. Finally, somebody came out and told us we could just set up on the, next to a ramp. I decided I would use the ramp as the stage for the kids, get under the ramp, and conduct from there. Now, I also had to plug in an electric guitar because I was the only accompaniment other than Mr. Carter, who played a little bit of drums. But tonally, I was the only accompaniment. So I had to plug the electric guitar the school had in with an extension cord. I'm sitting there, there's a smattering of parents. Now, I had to peel the kids away from their field day activities in order to get this to happen. Right? This is how ridiculous this is. Some of the kids are playing basketball and stuff. Some of the kids are playing, what do you call those? The things where you go through obstacle courses, throwing water balloons at each other. There's a freaking pizza party in the gymnasium. I have to get the kids to stop doing that stuff. The choir kids, and come in to choir to do this concert. Outside, we didn't know where it was at first, so I'm like mother duckling with like a couple of parents, some of the choir behind me, like they're like, where are we going? I'm like, I don't know, and I got my cords and my cables and my dumb little Fender amp, and not mine, but the school's. I'm walking around, where are we going? Just going nuts, my face is getting red. This is like my last 20 minutes of teaching. I was like, this is not how I want to spend it, because I was having a good day. Anyway, so I end up... You know what? What's this? Oh, this is 3 days ago. Okay, we need to turn you off, Messenger. Quit Messenger. I hope that works. I end up getting there. The kids are furious. I couldn't even get some of the kids to come. I even threatened. I was like, look, I'm going to give you a bad grade. If you don't come, your grade's going to suffer. They're like, what are you talking about? We got our grades in the mail yesterday. It's kind of fun. I mean, I have so many stories from the teaching part. I don't know why I'm just getting started. I think it's just, I'm just giving you the, hey, if you're thinking about becoming a public school teacher, get ready. so And I think I might do it next year. Or at least I might go back in as a teacher assistant. But I think I'm going to target a school that's closer to me. The commute was just like an hour and 20 minutes, which is way too long when you're getting up that early in the morning. I mean, we're talking 6 a.m. You know, I haven't done that in my entire life. I got a couple of gray hairs because of this job. I'm telling you. If I get some sort of life-ending disease in the next couple of... I know. I know what happened. So... The choir, kids, and I understand where you guys are coming from, but for crying out loud, just a little bit of character. You know, this is on you. Enough with the text. Jeez. Oh, you guys are probably so just over me right now. I understand. No, that's Logic Pro. I get it. I'm with you. I don't know what this is doing on, but we're going to go ahead and we're going to house everything. System preferences. I'm so sorry, guys. Just one second. Accounts. Sign out. Okay, that's it. No more dinging. No more donging. That's it. Choir kids get up. They start a revolt. A couple of them say, don't sing. They don't sing. Oh, there she is. Hey, how are you? Can I? Oh, you want to meet at the up coffee? I'm doing the intro right now. No, that's okay. What do you, is up okay? Is everything okay? Right. Oh, you're right by cup? No, you don't need to grab me a cup. If you're going to get coffee, I can get coffee later. Do you? I'll meet you a cup. I'm just going to finish this. I'll be there in a second. Does that sound good? Okay, bye, sweet. Okay, so it's the summertime now, so I get to drink some coffee and hang out with my girl. Yeah! What is it? Monday at 10:30? Oh, my God. God, these last 2 weeks have been beautiful. I've been writing music. Some of the kids didn't sing in the choir. They did not sing. It ended up being me just getting up there. I was just playing guitar and singing. I had to sing, of course, because I suddenly was thrust into the role of choir director. So I had to like pick songs, start singing. I never sang before. I never was in a choir. But I can match pitch. I was good at sight singing ear training. Anyway, I sang the thing myself. With a couple of people helping. A couple of people stood up, but almost all of them didn't sing. It's just me. A little solo Brett concert. I'll tell you all about it. I got into it, man. I was into it. I turned around. I loved it. With all the faculty was there. They were like, oh my God, did that just happen? I said, yeah. Yeah, that happened. The choir... Ladies and gentlemen, the choir did not sing. And I was concerned about the fact that we had to take it from soprano alto bass to soprano and alto. I was like, oh, this isn't going to sound good. The harmonies are going to be off. And all of a sudden, it just became karaoke, and then it boiled down to two or three kids singing. So I know that I'm going to be applying to new jobs, and I hope this isn't a reflection of my abilities. I also lead a great guitar ensemble in the city of kids. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. I was a preschool teacher for a year. I took a year off as a preschool teacher in Texas. I'm there. But we're just in a position in some of these schools, I think, where the kids just are not ready for school. Some of them. Some of them are, but some, the ones that aren't, it's a tough decision. What do you do with those? And it's a tough decision for everybody to make. So it was what a wonderful year in so many ways. I mean, a complete challenge, but the amount of stories and just being part of that community, really being part of the community and being part of the municipality of New York and stuff like that. It's a privilege. It felt like a service. And I'm glad that I did it. But I think that as far as service is concerned, I'm done. That's it. Anyway, the show, let's get on with the show. It was a beautiful experience. Thank you to everybody who helped me out there. The kids, I love you. Every single one of you I love. I want to make that completely clear. I loved teaching you what I was able to teach you. And some of you learned a lot. I'm 100 times the teacher I was before this. So if you're hiring, I'm telling you, there's no better choice than Big Diaper Brett for all of your educational needs. All right, let's get on with the show. Here's Lubos the Luthier.
And you said you're from what part of Prague? You said something west of Prague.
West of Prague, in a city, a small town called Kladno.
Kladno. Mm-hmm. Kladno.
K-L-A-D-N-O.
Kladno. Kladno. And that's a little bit west, you said.
West.
Right. So we're getting even further. So you kind of, yeah, so you're going to have more of that that European than the Serbian influences of where he's from, it seems to be, right?
Yes.
Did you feel that growing up? Did you feel like a little bit more of a pull towards Western Europe than you think someone like Vladislav did?
It's Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
The culture and everything, and before the Iron Curtain, we were like pretty much isolated from the Western world.
And you were still kind of Serbian almost.
Yeah, it was the Austrian Empire,
mm-hmm.
and the First Republic from 1914 to 1919 when they broke away and established their own nation, the Czechoslovakia.
Yeah. So you feel that? You feel Eastern European?
Sure.
Yeah. And what do you think that means? I mean, as far as like, you know, Eastern, feeling that, I don't know. You know, I've heard of like, you know, I hope I'm not being offensive at all, but I've heard of like the Russian soul, you know, being referenced to, like, you know what I mean, as being sort of its own thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to get into politics too deep, but yes, we were like governed by the Russian after World War II.
Right. Yeah.
And that Iron Curtain was the isolation from the Western world, mm-hmm. and the culture and all the activities.
And you were aware of that. You're old enough to have been affected by that.
Yeah, I grew up in the hardcore of the communism.
The hardcore of it.
Hardcore, yes. The worst part of the communism. And luckily, I managed to emigrate before the military service.
Before 1968?
Oh, yeah. I emigrated in 1983.
Oh, okay.
I was born 1964, so 1983. I was 19.
Oh, okay.
I was 18 when I left the country, and turned 19 when I was in Austria in a refugee camp for 6 months. And there I was waiting for the political assignment to the United States.
So you went through all that? You went through the refugee camp?
Yeah.
To get to the U.S.?
Yeah. I had to escape from the country.
Who were you with anybody else at that point?
No, I was alone.
So you were in your 20s, early 20s?
Yeah.
And you decided. What made you make that decision?
The decision was pretty much the freedom that I knew that I don't have and I never will during the communist regime. So,
did you discover that as a student? Because that's not something that I assume everybody, like when I talk to, you know, Cubans sometimes, they're not really aware of how oppressive it is until they kind of grow up and then they, you know, sometimes realize, oh my God, I actually can't do what I
Well, you know to. There is something up there.
You know there's something
the West,
up there.
Yes, yeah. In the West.
But you don't have access to it.
You don't have access, but you could, you will always find out through people that were in the West. And there was also a radio station in Washington, D.C. called Voice of America. They were broadcasting, it was illegal to listen to it. And they were talking about the news and stuff and you know, how things are there. And you heard this tennis player, Martina Navratilova, emigrated. And I was like, I can do the same thing.
Right. But you weren't allowed to listen to it, but they couldn't stop you. It's the airwaves.
It was hard. It was like a low frequency on the radio. We knew the frequency of the waves. And
were you afraid of listening to it?
Sure.
Yeah.
You cannot listen to it in public. You have to listen to it at home.
Yeah.
Like, we would be camping, we were on vacation, we would listen to it.
He'd be like, let's listen to the radio.
Turn the volume down a little bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, that got me the idea.
So, you had this since you were a kid?
I had this on my mind since I was maybe like 15.
Yeah.
And I was 18 when I graduated.
Yeah.
I have a bachelor degree in metallurgy.
Really?
Yes. And nothing to do with the guitars or anything, but I was living in a town where this industry was like booming.
Well, the engineering aspect of it probably helps with the guitar making. But yeah, you're saying metallurgy, am I saying, I mean, is yes.
It's so making iron.
You're learning how to make iron. So at that point, they're thinking, this kid's going to help us make, you know, some
what
stuff.
What helped me the most for the guitar?
For the military.
What helped me the most was that the fact that I was a musician. I am a musician. Yeah. I'm a mainly mandolin player. I play guitar. And I learned how to do the repairs. Huh. I start building in Czech Republic. I start repairing Czech Republic. And I also built model airplanes and boats. Mostly airplanes, like the gliders.
Yeah, I did. And they actually work?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And reading those blueprints, working with the balsa wood, I build balsa sandwich top now, so I have flashbacks of, what do you call it,
making little airplanes. Yeah.
Working with
gliders.
The balsa wood.
Yeah.
And that sense for details helped me to build the guitars and the patience to it.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly, and that's interesting because when you build a guitar, you know, I know that Gary's approach. I don't know. You've obviously met Gary downstairs because he's at the festival too, but he has sort of an engineering or a mathematical, very mathematical approach which takes patience. You know,
actually, his profession has nothing to do with building guitars, but he's a musician.
Yeah, he's a doctor.
A dad has
or something
to do with it. The love for the music. And the fact you can create your own guitars, that's exactly what happened to me in a way, except I was in the metallurgy business.
Yeah, and why were you in that business?
I had to.
Forced you into it?
There was either coal mining or making iron.
Yeah.
It was a very industrial city. Most of the city, 90% of the population from the city was working either for the factory making the iron or for being coal miners.
Right.
That's what it was.
And so there were people mining it, and then there were people refining it.
Yes.
And you were part of the refining process?
Yes.
Is that what metallurgy is?
Yes.
It's when you take something and you refine it?
Yeah, you melt the minerals and the wood and in a specific order.
Yeah,
and
get the good stuff
recipe,
out.
And you build rails, beams, all kind of products for...
Is that something that you were interested in at all? Or are they just literally handed you a card, you opened it up, and it said, you're going to be making metal?
This is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. Yes.
And
like it or not, you will do this.
Right. I imagine that just simply having it put to you that way is going to make it where... I forgot to turn my phone off, but, you know. Let me see.
Me too. It's okay.
This is a... There we go. I'm going to slide it off. But I'd assume that having it put to you that way is enough to just sort of turn you off. Where you're just like, I haven't even had a chance to think about what I want to do.
That kind of stereotype of life wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And people telling you what to do, that wasn't me.
No, it wasn't.
So I made the decision. I bought this trip, one chance I had to go to former Yugoslavia on a trip through Italy and return back through Vienna, Austria. And when they made that stop, it was just to make it short, I had to get all kinds of approvals. Approvals from my employer, who was the factory making the iron, or I had to go back to school where I graduated to have my professor sign it and give me the approval to leave the country. So I took a chance. I went to the school. Although I wasn't a student anymore, I graduated. The professor signed it for me. Because the employer would not sign it for me to leave the country. So I had one chance before the military service, which was mandatory back then.
Yeah.
I escaped before the military service with the help of the professor who signed and gave me the permission to leave the country. And I stayed in Austria, in Vienna.
Wow. Yeah. So you went to Vienna.
I went to Vienna.
So the thing is that what you do is you start out with getting sort of this visitation documentation going, where they think you're
like
coming
a visa.
Back.
Visa.
Right.
You needed a visa. It was difficult to get.
I don't understand. So it's very difficult to get, but it's just basically a lot of different people from institutions.
Yes.
Saying this is a good guy. He'll come back.
Yeah.
We're sending him there for a reason.
But to make it easy, I went to the teacher.
Yeah.
Because as a student, you didn't have to ask many people.
Yeah.
As a student, it was just straightforward.
Yeah.
And
I remember that. I remember in the 80s, there'd be like, I feel like there were Russian exchange students. Maybe I'm wrong, but
yeah,
I feel like there were students coming and going, right?
Correct?
Yeah, so that they could study things and, you know, move around.
But it was always through some kind of a connection.
Some kind of a connection. Your connection was a college professor.
Yeah.
And did he know that you weren't coming back?
Oh, he knew.
Was he happy for you?
No, he said, I cannot elaborate on this, but I'm telling you, life of an emigrant, as an emigrant, is tough.
Yeah.
And I didn't answer. I was laughing. He was laughing too. He goes, here you go.
So he
signed it.
So he was like, look, you know.
He knew it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knew. He could easily give me up. And nobody knew. My parents, my friends, nobody knew I was doing this. I was alone.
What about your parents?
They didn't know. They knew that I was going on vacation. I didn't tell them I will stay because they would stop the bus.
Do you think that they were communist pro?
No. They weren't. USA. They're parents.
They're just parents. Yeah.
You know, you leave the country. You don't know if you will ever come back.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when I left the country, and I left before the military service, which was mandatory, I was already like drafted to the service.
Yeah.
Because I was drafted and the service was mandatory, I was a military deserter. And for that, there was a death penalty. So I actually had a death penalty.
Yeah.
when they changed the system in 19...
First time on this show.
When they changed
the system. You got a guy with a price on his head, folks.
1989, they changed all that. And they called an amnesty for political refugees. And I wanted to have that in writing because I had a death penalty. And they sent it to me in writing. You are free to come back.
Oh, my God.
So I was only 25. It was unbelievable.
They said, do you trust them?
They sent it to me.
Okay. So, but you trusted that you could go back. So
there's a consulate in Manhattan.
You went back before 1990. You went back before the wall came down.
After. Shortly after that. Okay. The wall came down in, I think it was in
November. 89, I don't know. November 89.
November 89.
I remember it was at Christmas time or something.
So the summer, the following summer, I went home.
And so you were 25 when you went home.
Yeah.
So how many years did you spend here then? Four? That's almost fortunate because you...
6 years.
I mean, it's a long time to not know what's going on. That's got to be terrible. But you had not seen your parents for 6 years.
No. And I didn't know if I will ever come back because I had a death penalty.
What did your mom do? When she saw you again.
Oh, that was very emotional.
Is she an emotional person?
Yeah.
And your dad?
We all are.
You all are very... Yeah. Yeah. So it was just... I mean, it was... Were you able to communicate with them?
Yes. There was another thing. Because I emigrated, they wanted to know what's going on.
Yeah.
So they gave them... It was very difficult to get a landline, telephone. They gave it to them immediately and tapped to the phone immediately. So I called them many times. We never talk about anything, about general things.
Yeah,
but they were listening. Always.
The government was.
Oh, yeah.
So they're like, you guys can talk, but we have to listen to what you're saying.
Yeah. They didn't tell us they were listening, but I knew they were.
How do you know?
You hear it on the radio. People tell you stories. It was normal.
Yeah.
They would even break into people's apartment and search when you were not there, when you were working.
This is so interesting because Vladislav... had said that the military more or less... What's the town he's from? The second biggest town? The Moravian town?
Brno and...
Brno. That's what he's talking about. He said he was from there and that the military more or less kind of went around them and kind of left them alone. Was that sort of the case?
They went to Prague, yeah.
In the east. Yeah. But Prague, yeah, because in Prague, I guess I...
Yeah,
I thought there was a lot of military stuff going on.
Oh, yeah, there was.
Based on just like reading some books about
that was in 1968, 69, yeah.
Yeah.
It was the invasion, mm-hmm. The Soviet invasion, yeah.
Yeah, what's that book? The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Yes.
Milan Kundera. I haven't seen it, I just read the book. But it's about that.
There is a movie. I've seen it a long time ago. I'd like to see it again.
Ah.
About the doctor, the surgeon, the brain surgeon.
Yeah, he's a doctor, yeah. And then it becomes like a window washer.
Yes, yes, that's it.
And the idea being that he's happy as a window washer because it was too stressful to be a doctor, which is obviously like very, very, I mean, it's very interesting, very, I guess, because Milan Kundera, I guess, he's Czech, is he?
Oh, yeah.
He's one of my favorite authors.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so that, it's sort of... ends on sort of a high, sort of pro-communist note.
Yes, yes.
But as far as being there for that, did you listen to any of that music? What's that guy? There's one, like, he's very popular right now. He's got sort of this resurgence in the U.S., this Czech sort of, or my dad was listening to him, I think, and he fell in love with him. I forget his name, but he's like a revolutionary Czech, like the Bob Dylan of Czechoslovakia.
Oh, yeah. That was two.
What's his name?
One was Karel Gott, and the other was Valdemar Matuska.
Maybe the Gott guy.
Both of them were here.
Uh-huh.
Very popular.
Matuska, and railing against the...
Matuska did a lot of concerts here in Manhattan.
Yeah.
There's a big Czech... used to be a big Czech community. It's not big anymore, but there is still Czech community here.
Yeah.
In Astoria now. Astoria, Queens.
Astoria, they still have it? Do you have family there?
No, I have friends. There's a couple of restaurants.
When you were communicating with your parents and then, you know, at that point, was that the point when you got to America? What did you study here?
What I did here was I went to the restaurant business.
Yeah, like how did it work? So you just straight, yeah, first thing you do, you're like...
You need to do something.
You gotta do something. You can't just start making guitars.
I couldn't do anything with the metallurgy. I would have to go to Detroit, maybe. Mm. I didn't want to go there. So I figured I'm going to do a different field. I was in Boston first.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was working there in a restaurant. I met a lot of... it was interesting. There was a couple of people from in Berklee College of Music.
Oh.
Milan Svoboda. He was a director of the Prague big band, of jazz band. He was studying there. And there was a piano player and guitarist. I forgot the names. So many years. 1984. So I was in Boston about 8 months. Then I had a cousin from Chicago who moved to Florida, to Miami. And I moved to Miami with him. I was there 5 years. And then I came to New York. Yeah. But those years, even in the Berklee College of Music...
So most of the time you're in Miami.
Yeah.
Going back.
I started guitar repairs in Boston for the guys that I was connected with the Berklee College of Music. So that's how I started. But I had no workshop or anything to do, just repairs, light refinishing. Then I moved to Miami. There was another Czech family who had... They emigrated in 1948. That was the first biggest emigration wave. Mm. They had kids working on the ocean liners as musicians. So through them, I did some repairs too. And I started doing building there a little bit. I'm sorry. I started building.
It's okay.
Then I moved to New York. I had a big gap of a guitar building or anything because I couldn't have space. And I moved to New Jersey in 2002.
Yeah.
And there, I had a small workshop, horrible conditions, no light. Always problem get the power for the power tools.
Always.
Yeah.
Sorry about this. I'm just going to move this a little bit. This might help.
Yeah. And
that way...
And then finally in 2006, I bought this house in Sussex County, New Jersey, where I live until today. And that's a house with a walk-out basement. The basement is about 1,200 square feet, 12 huge windows looking at the golf course, and I build the guitars there.
That's how it happened.
That's what I do now. I build guitars there. I even modified that room so I can spray with the lacquer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very, very hard for a lot of guitar builders to have that facility at home, spraying facility.
A spraying facility with a lacquer.
Yeah.
Do you think it's why a lot of... Well, so that's, you know, that's one thing that I've noticed with some guitar makers who are either just getting started or maybe have a smaller shop is that they usually go with a lot less lacquer, like a French polish or something.
Actually,
like
I do French polish too.
Yeah.
It's the best way to finish the guitar, but I can spray if I want to. I have...
You set up. Yeah, exactly. But you seem to like a light. I mean, it seems to me like you have a lighter finish than some guitars.
Very light. All very French light. Polish now.
All French polish. You always do French polish.
Up until 2 years ago, I was lacquering the back and the sides of the guitar, mm-hmm. and the rest was French polish, like the top, which mm-hmm. is the most important part.
And what do you think that does? It just allows the membrane to vibrate a little more?
Yes.
And that's the main thing right there.
Because the shellac is so thin. It's like the chrome on your watch. That's how thin it is. So literally, you just cover the wood with shellac until you get a little gloss.
Yeah.
And that's the best way to for the resonation.
Well, also, you also get some, what would you call it? It's porous or whatever.
Yes.
You know, you can actually feel the wood.
Yes.
That way, too, not just see it. It's a very beautiful effect. And what kind of woods do you use? Where do you get your woods from?
I have several sources. The fancy wood from Brazil. I have another source. I can get the African blackwood, which is very popular.
The fancy wood? You mean the fancy, the rose?
Exotic
Brazilian
wood.
Rosewood?
Exotic wood.
Yeah.
Expensive wood.
Yeah.
Good-looking wood. Good-sounding wood.
Good-looking wood.
And expensive.
And that's for the back and sides?
That's for the back and sides.
And then for the top, you're using, it seems like there's a lot of spruce going on downstairs. Is that true?
I have two cedar tops, one new, one old.
Mm-hmm.
I get the cedar from,
I completely got that wrong then.
Canadian Western Red Cedar and the spruce. I like the Alaskan Engelmann spruce from here. The Alaskan Sitka, Engelmann spruce from the West Coast.
So a lot of what you'd like is North American woods.
But also European, German, and Italian.
Oh, so you get them all over the place. But so you use the Canadian, cedar.
Cedar.
The spruce is from Alaska, you were saying.
Yes.
And then you were moving on to, you said you also do some European woods. Like what? Where's that from again?
From Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of spruce from Cremona, Italy.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, why there? Now, Cremona, is that that's North Italy?
Yes.
Okay, so that's the Alpine sort of...
Yeah, it's from the Alps. That's exactly where Antonius Stradivarius got his...
That's where I think spruce. I've heard that before.
Yes, from that region.
And is that the one where it goes down to the... Do you get... Is it low-altitude spruce or high-altitude or...?
It's about 2,500 feet above the sea level.
Yeah, is that high or low? That's a lot.
It's about average.
Average.
It's like the best.
It's like where you're farming, like the bottom of a delta.
800 to 1,000 meters above the sea level.
Right, so as far as that's concerned, I mean, do you pay attention to where your wood comes from as far as like sea level?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
You do. Because that's when I talked to a builder at the festival last year. I was really, William Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking. Bill Kramer, he was talking about that a lot.
Yes,
had a lot of insight that he shared with that. And the sea level is basically the salt affects the characteristics of the wood.
Yes,
it also hardens the wood.
The growth of the wood,
right?
The humidity,
right? The humidity.
The light.
The light.
Yes.
What do you mean by the light?
When it grows slowly, you get a tighter ring, and when you quarter the wood, you get a much better tap tone. It doesn't have the chance to...
What is a tap tone? When you tap it and you hear it again?
At a certain space on the board, you tap and listen to this tone.
And that's how you determine?
Yeah.
Where?
It's a fresh, clear tone. It's usually A to G sharp.
Right.
There is a way to do it. I would have to show it to you. You have to hold it in a certain spot and tap on it in a certain way.
You have to show it to me. Will you do that at the end of this? Look for tap tone, folks. So you're tapping it, and what are you doing? Are you waiting for the decay?
Yeah.
Are you timing the decay?
You hear how it rings, how it responds to your tap. And also, what I like to do, I have never seen that done before from anyone. I tap on it, and I sort of scratch the wood with my nails across the grain. And when you're scratching it, you're listening to it, and it sort of shivers, the wood.
Yeah.
And that's, I feel the response to it, to the scratching.
But
I don't scratch hard. I just go over it with my nail.
Right.
And you can listen to it. It's like shivering. Like, shaking in your hand.
So when you want, oh, and you feel it too.
You feel the vibration.
And you also feel the grain of the wood.
Yeah.
And your decision is going to be based on just years of really having experience and finding the way. I assume that it's a personal thing, so that becomes almost an aural aesthetic decision.
Yes.
Where you're actually...
You make a judgment on this.
You're making a judgment on this. And you get an idea of, like, what feels good, what feels bad, you know?
You do
what's
that.
Beautiful, what's not beautiful. Yeah. You're assigning that to certain, you know, distances between rings in a piece of wood. Fascinating.
It's a signal to you.
Mm-hmm.
You listen to it, you feel it.
Yeah.
And you said, you make a note on it with the pencil.
You
this,
do.
This is the set.
How do you, what do you call it? When you're sitting there and you're scratching a guitar, which, you know, kids at home, don't do this at home. Don't go around scratching guitars trying to figure out if they work or not.
I make grades, yeah. My own grading on it.
Uh-huh.
Like you buy wood from a supplier.
Sure.
They call it, you get the 2A, which is so-so, 3A is a good grade, very good grade, then you have 4A is a master grade.
Now, but what determines that? Is there a tighter distance between the rings? The grain is tighter?
Yes.
So the tighter the grain, the better the guitar?
Not necessarily.
The higher the grade.
Sometimes you get a better, good tone with the wider grain too, but it's like the suppliers, they grade the wood themselves and they sell it at the price. Then they send it to you, and you determine if they're right or wrong.
Right.
That's why it's best if you go to the lumber yard and try it for yourself before you ship it.
Now, when you do that, when you're at the lumber yard, you're doing the same thing. You're scratching.
Yeah, sure.
But at that point, you can scratch the shit out of it because it's okay.
It's not really. You see, the board is 5/16, quarter of an inch. Yeah. And you are not really making a gouges in it with your nails. It's just a reference.
I like it. It's a reference. I mean, your ear is to the sound hole when you're doing this. And you're looking for something that's just the right of brightness and just the right of warmth.
Yeah.
When you say it has a shiver to it, do you look for that shiver to sort of trigger certain frequencies in your head and your body?
Yeah.
In your arm?
Something. It almost like tickles.
Yeah, that's what I'm imagining. Like it gives you goosebumps. It makes your hair stand up a little bit.
And with that, you actually can determine the density of the wood and the weight.
Yeah.
You can feel that. It's going to be lively wood.
Lively wood.
And then
you
make a note, your own grading, you put it on the side. There's also moisture content. Shouldn't be more than 12%.
And how do you measure moisture content in a piece of wood?
It's like a little device, electronic device with two prongs, like a needles.
Mm-hmm.
You stick it to the side of the wood, dig like a needle, stick it in there, you get the reading.
Okay, and you're doing that not to a full, you're doing that to a piece of wood, I guess. It's not, you're not doing it to a guitar yet. So you can just take that piece of wood and throw it away.
You do it on the side.
And then as far as your approach to making, are you doing double top, single top? Lattice bracing, like what can you tell us about the way that you approach, the way you make your tops?
Up until 2014, every luthier was always looking for to build an instrument that's loud.
Yeah.
From Antonio de Torres until today. And there was many different ways to do that. Like you said, the lattice brace guitars are really loud.
Yeah.
But you get the volume, you miss something else, like the timbre sound, the color.
Yeah.
You know, you get, it just basically goes one way, and it's loud. That's why a lot of people like the traditional instruments, where they can create their own sound on it, the variation of the tone, especially on the spruce. Not so much with the cedar. Cedar will be always a little bit on the dark side.
It will be what it will be. That's what I've heard.
It is.
Cedar.
It is.
It is what it is. Whereas a spruce, people who like to control every aspect, of their tone, have a little more option.
Spruce many more options than the cedar.
How do, really? And you can hear that. Really, I mean, I understand that, but I don't. I mean, I don't know it in practice. I just haven't been around enough guitars.
Yeah, the spruce will be bright. And you can play it pianissimo easy.
The big thing is spruce, light, cedar, dark.
Yeah.
That's sort of the big thing.
But
now I'm starting to understand more about the spruce being a more versatile wood from a tonal standpoint.
Yes.
And then cedar being obviously very beautiful, very warm, very what we think we want in a guitar, especially when we first become guitarists. You know, just going for that warm, the warm sound of a nylon string versus the bright sound of a steel string.
Yeah.
So we're kind of like moving away from that when we're younger, and then as we get older, we kind of want something a little more playful. And so, I don't know. Do you think, I mean, do you think spruce may be the choice of the more mature guitarist?
This is a big question. Because you see, a lot of...
And I, by the way, I do not mean what I say. I'm just
high-end guitarists.
Fun.
They will say you have to have a spruce on the stage.
I'm getting that.
And then later
these
on, they play cedar themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
We have the right to make a decision about that.
Yeah, maybe it's like pushback against John Williams. See, John Williams always plays a cedar, and now everybody's like, oh, you know. But I don't know if that's the case. I mean, I'm being kind of a punk right now. That's the way I feel. But at the same time, I'm just wondering. What the deal is? What's the deal with spruce? Because it's here. I mean, it's definitely more and more players are advocating for spruce
in a simple language.
And they're getting very. The opinions are getting stronger for spruce than I've ever seen them before.
So let's say simply, spruce is more difficult to play.
Yeah, it is, because you can hear everybody's nails. You know, it's very exposed.
But once you can control the spruce, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah. My guitar is a spruce. And I always said, like, oh, I wish I had a cedar. But, I found a way to make it warm. It's warm enough.
Yep.
There's nothing worse than a player who's kind of a naily player in the first place, though, when he's playing a spruce. That's when it gets a little... It doesn't get worse. It becomes almost a little more folksy.
Yeah, yeah. So this goes for the solid tops. Solid spruce, solid top. Yeah. Then you have these lattice brace guitars, where the top, like the Greg Smallman from Australia, the top is like 1/16. And he will have the lattice pattern bracing underneath with this huge frame... To keep the sides and the body rigid, and this creates enormous frequency.
Sound
and frequency.
Truss rod too doesn't hurt either.
So that was one way to make it loud.
Right.
Then, how much time we? I mean, I can talk for hours.
We're only like 30 minutes in.
Then these two gentlemen from Germany, Gernot Wagner and Matthias Dahmann, they came. The late 70s, they built those double tops. And the idea was from a friend who was building model airplanes.
So the double top is not Greg Smallman's invention?
No, not at all.
It is Dahmann and who?
Gernot Wagner.
Wagner.
Okay. Matthias Dahmann.
Yeah.
So he used... this friend was building these airplanes with this Nomex, this composite material. And he said, gee, I can use that on a guitar. It's so light and rigid. And he did that. But before he did this, Gernot Wagner...
But he's just building the back and sides. He's building the foundation of the guitar. He's building the frame of it with this composite material.
Yes, only the top.
So it's only under the top?
Only the top.
But the top itself is spruce or cedar or something?
Yes. There is two layers, two soundboards.
The bracing is actual composite material. It's not wood.
It's wood with the Dahmann. It's
composite wood. Meaning?
It's like a sheet of honeycomb material.
Yeah.
That you sandwich.
But I mean, natural material. Composite meaning like wood that's been burnt into charcoal? I don't know what I'm talking about. But I thought composite meant not natural.
Exactly.
So it's not natural.
It's not.
So the bracing is made out of like man-made materials. Chemical materials.
Yes, the sandwich.
Chemical composites.
Nomex, yes.
Okay.
So he figured that system for the frequency and the weight of the soundboard. And once you glue that, the sandwich, it will do the magic. The sandwich top with the bracing, you will get this...
this certain tone?
Projection, the tone, high tone, and large projection. Mm-hmm. They will just cut through the crowd. And... that was basically... that was my phone.
Oh my God, no, I thought I was like, is somebody actually just standing outside our window and playing?
So that was the revolutionary...
Wait, what is the...
That was a revolutionary.
What does it ring on your phone now? What is it?
There was a text.
But is it your guitar? Is the sound your guitar being played?
No.
It goes, did. It sounds like a guitar.
No. It was just a ring.
Okay, sorry. The revolutionary, the Diamond was a revolutionary, the bracing was a revolutionary.
This
is the 70s.
Lattice brace, then the double tap from Matthias Damann, Gernot Wagner. Mm-hmm. It's a collaboration. Those two were like revolutionary. Then Matthias Damann and Gernot Wagner had a friend. They have a friend, actually, now. His name is Antonius Miller. He adapted the sandwich, except he put these balsa sticks instead of the Nomex in between the sandwich. And that's what I built, balsa double top, right now. I met Tony Miller 4 years ago in Czech Republic with Vladislav Blas Festival. Vladislav owns his guitar, and I start talking to Tony. We became really good friends. He gave me the permission to build this guitar. So I adapted the top from him. I designed the rest of the guitar, including the bracing, but I'm using the sandwich top from Tony Miller.
You're still using that?
No, and I will be using it
until the day you die.
Yeah.
And you're so right now you are doing a double top guitar.
Only double top.
Only double top.
I don't do the trunchlet anymore.
The truss rod. You do not do that anymore.
The traditional construction, like the one you have.
That's what you have.
I used to build that uh-huh. up until 3.5 years ago.
And you're right. You are right. The one I have is traditional construction, but it is a Lattice bracing.
Oh, you have a Lattice bracing?
Yeah, I think I have a double top. Yeah. Oh, I don't know that much about it because I don't know the maker. But it is that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then.
But so, as far as what's going on with you, how, you know, that is sort of, we go in and out of these ideas. There is there are the makers that are, you know, that do a lot more by feel maybe than other makers do.
Yes.
And it seems you are striking me as someone who makes decisions based on not only, you know, obviously you're sitting there, you're dealing with, like you said, you're gonna get tickled, and when you get tickled, you know you got something good. So that's using your gut for sure. But as far as the debate between strictly traditional, you know, single top models with, you know, limited bracings, you sort of stand on sort of the side of, it seems like you have chosen something a little more like the revolutionary bracings of the double top and,
yes,
and the Lattice. And you do that based on projection. And is there another reason you do it? Because it seems like some people, again, are getting very strong opinions about whether that's right or not, you know.
You know, when you build a guitar, of course you want to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
You want the guitar to sound great.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one reason.
Yeah.
It's also nice to see it on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see the young kids winning competition, having your guitar.
And they're going to do that with a loud guitar.
And I have 7 prizes already, as of now.
You do?
7 prizes.
7 prizes.
3 first, couple of seconds, and the 3rd places at the international competitions.
This is it?
All that in 3 years.
Can I borrow $100?
So, what was the question? Yeah, you do it for that reason, you know.
You do it so people can hear the guitar, for Christ's sakes.
It's a nice attention. People respect you.
Right. And also, it's. Let's get this straight. Your guitars, from a visual aesthetic standpoint, are gorgeous.
Thank you.
They're very traditional in that sense. You don't have any sound ports, nothing like that, right?
No, not now. There is some things I don't like to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not against it, like the sound ports. I just don't think it's necessary.
And they're reasonably priced? Your guitars are reasonably priced?
Yes.
We're not talking... Yeah, they're like, you want people to play them.
Yeah. I'm trying to keep the price low.
Yeah, you are.
I mean, it is...
So is Gary. You and Gary both are kind of like in this realm of not... or at least he was. I don't know what he's doing now. I gotta talk to him.
Yeah, it's...
it seems like there are makers that, you know, value people having access to their guitars that, you know, more than 12 people being able to play them, you know.
Look, this is the price is one thing. The second thing is how much time do you spend to build that guitar?
Mm.
So I designed the guitar, my guitar, in a way that I don't have to spend all these hours like I used to. For example, my necks... have these elevated fingerboard, and I don't glue them on the body. I bolt them. Just like it's a lot of people's doing it now, so I'm doing it too. I bolt the neck on a guitar. It's not glued. In other words, I can disassemble the neck anytime I want for a repair, for a touch-up, for anything. Mm-hmm. And it saves me about 15 hours of labor just not gluing that neck to the body.
Right. Why is that so labor-intensive?
If you glue the neck to the body and you have the elevated fingerboard, you have to fit it and make the body-neck angle exactly, because there is only one chance to do that. If you don't glue it right, or if you have the wrong angle, you will have either very low action or very high action, because it will not be set up properly.
Right.
So that's one thing you have to consider. That kind of setup can take a lot of headache. So I don't do that.
Yeah.
So I just fit the body, and I fit the angle at the very last minute.
Yeah.
On it. And simply bolt it there. So I don't have
and
any...
And if you make a mistake, you
can correct
it.
If the neck warps, it can happen. It can be in a weather in, I don't know, in Europe, Asia, the player can come back. Look at my neck. Look at the high action. It moved. I can loosen it up and reset it.
Yeah, you don't have to scrap the whole guitar.
Yeah.
Because the neck bowed, which is what necks are born to do.
That's exactly what happens with a lot of guitars.
All of them, eventually. Well, maybe not all of them, though. Isn't that weird?
Some.
Yeah.
But when that happens,
yeah,
it's a souvenir.
Yeah.
You cannot play it anymore.
I know. It's a souvenir now.
So I want to avoid that part. And at the same time, I save about 15 hours of labor. There is a lot of other things that I do to save time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, that's totally fascinating. The fact that you can produce more guitars... do you have that in mind? You're like, okay, instead of raising the price, what can I do to make this less labor intensive so I can make more of them and more people can have them?
So I keep the price low and I work less hours to build a guitar.
Okay.
That's it. I maximize the hourly earnings.
Tempted to call it genius. I maximize
that makes sense,
hourly
right?
Yeah, it does make sense. It does make
sense. It is labor intensive.
But the fact that you see the process of the buying and selling process as a sort of organism, you know, that it has, you know, that is finite, and that kind of moves between the two is really, I mean, that's really the way that everybody should be doing business. You know, I've railed at some points against how expensive guitars have gotten, because those guitars are being played by Manuel Barweco and some schmuck in you know, Maine, that can't play guitar but is a collector and has a bunch of money.
Yes.
And I don't understand why those guys are the ones with those. But the guitar market should not be based on those people.
Yeah.
You know, and then given to Elliot Fisk. You know what I mean?
It could be astronomical because of someone played as true.
Mm-hmm.
Or the auction houses.
Yeah.
They prop the historical vintage guitars prices. I don't want to name, but some of them are like $250,000. It's just a regular guitar.
It's just a regular guitar.
And I have seen them. I had them at home.
Yeah.
Like, come on. This is the auction houses. The people, they are willing to pay that because somebody hyped it up.
Yeah. Well, they put it on a red pillow and there's a, you know, there's a little man with a nice suit on pointing to it.
This guitar comes with a letter from this person dedicated to this person. Because of that letter, the guitar is $20,000 more. The provenance, they call it. Provenance.
Yeah,
that's how it is. Yeah. Just like the Stradivarius.
Oh, yeah. It's just like going to the Met. You know, I mean, I always want to feel more than I feel when I look at the... it's Segovia's guitars in the Met, or...
I actually have seen them.
It's just like, you're just like, yeah.
I had a friend there who was working that he retired.
I feel bad, because it is nice that they're there. I mean, I'm glad. I mean, he's my heart, you know, he's the soul of what we do. I'm not taking that away from him, but, you know.
There's a lot of other guitars at the Met Museum that I have seen, from Christopher Parkin and Julian Bream.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen them. I studied them.
Yeah.
I had the permission to go in.
I haven't played them, but yeah, it'd be nice to be able to play them.
Yeah, I play all of them, and also in Christie's, these auctions.
You go and you play those?
Yes.
Right.
I can get private viewing if I want to. And
how? Just as being a maker?
No, I know the people there.
You know the Christie's people?
Yes.
That'll do it. That'll do it.
I just go there.
So some of them, you're just playing them. You're like, this isn't even a good starter guitar, and yeah. It's going for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's to be expected with certain instruments. But I think, you know, the makers. It's almost like, who's ruining New York City? Is it you know, rich white kids, or is it greedy landlords? It's greedy landlords, dude. You know, so it's like, it's the same with the guitar market. You're just like, okay, well, you know, is there a way for, does it become an issue of class? Is there no room for socialism in America, my friend? You know, as far as like, can we make these guitars affordable to normal people?
Yeah.
Or do parents have to take what they would spend on a new car that they need and spend it on a guitar
that
their kid may need? In 5 years, it's a rough thing. So yeah, keeping the price down is important. But you know, by talking to the luthiers, the amount of work that they're putting into their guitars, the amount of time, the amount of space, the amount of real estate,
that
you're saying that goes into it. Like you're saying, you're lucky to have that, the ability to finish your own guitars, the training, experience. Yes. Yes, at least, you know, there is a reason why they are expensive.
You know, I study not just guitar construction, but I study as much as I could the life of the luthiers, the famous luthiers. And I tell you, it wasn't pretty.
No?
A lot of them were, like, living in poverty.
Yeah.
Either New York City or Europe or Spain or wherever.
Right.
So you study, you look at that. Now they're famous, they don't even know it.
Yeah.
And their guitars are selling through the roof.
Right.
I bet you that if they knew, they couldn't believe it.
Can you think of one luthier that you're thinking of? Sure.
Emilio Esteso, during the Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. Santos Hernandez. Herman Hauser, the most famous one.
So we were just talking about him.
Yeah.
So what's Herman Hauser's story? He was unknown. Did he die before Segovia? Or did he, like...
He died in 1952.
Oh, my God. So he didn't even get to see anything happen.
Yeah, he built a guitar for Segovia in 1937, the famous model.
Sure.
But so he was around to experience that. He was sick. Always had trouble with money. He would build guitar for somebody just to have a 6 months worth of grocery shopping, like that.
Yeah.
I heard all these stories from the German people. I go to Europe a lot lately.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about guitars. And
when you went to Vienna, you know, is that where you started? You didn't start doing it there. You started it in Boston, like you said.
Yes.
But what happened in Vienna musically?
Well, I was there in emigration, as an immigrant, so... Mm-hmm. I wasn't around really focusing. I was there 6 months.
And you're a kid, too. You're probably just drinking.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I was 18, 19.
You're finally out. There's women.
I came to the United States. I was 19. I wasn't even allowed to drink alcohol. Because you had to be 21 to drink.
you like Pilsner or Kel or no? What are we talking about? The reason I bring up that Pilsner or Kel is just as a side note. That's Czech beer, right? Oh. That stuff, promise.
The plum brandy, where Vladislav Blaha lives, in Moravia.
He's saying it's wine country, but you're from beer country.
Yeah, he's from the wine country, and the plum brandy. It's made from plums. It's like a clear, they call it Slivovit, if you heard. Slivovit.
Slivovit?
Slivovit. They sell it here, too.
Slivovit, white, something white?
Yeah, it's clear. It's like a vodka, clear liquor, but made from plums.
It's made from plums. Is it too sweet?
No, it's actually rough.
I like it. That sounds great.
I used to love that. Yeah. And where Vladislav lives, they make the best.
Now, he told me also, you know, this will probably be the folklore of the Moravian, where he's from, the eastern, southeastern part, the stuff that's closer to Serbia and stuff like that. You, of course, being closer to Austria and Germany, in Prague, and that's Bohemia. Bohemia, much more of a beer culture. Moravia, much more of a wine, yes. Vine culture.
Yes.
Brandy.
Yes.
So all that stuff that's that actually the folklore talks more.
Yes.
The old songs, that you know, the poetry is more about wine, where he's from and over where you're from. It's in the beer.
Yes.
So what's beer poetry like?
Huh, I never thought of that, but it's I would say it's more classical and jazz than folk.
Right.
Yeah.
It
pops,
is.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gatherings together.
Yeah.
In Moravia, it's more like a folk.
Yeah. Campfires.
I think I'm right about that.
I think that's what he said,
yeah.
too. That's it. I got to go to Prague. I want to go to Prague very badly. As a matter of fact, maybe I'll go to Prague this summer.
Why don't you go next summer and go to the Brno Festival, to Vladislav Blaha?
I should go.
You play a lot of guitar there. You will see a lot of concerts. And you will have...
How many miles is it away?
Oh, it's with the train, like 2 hours from Prague.
So we could do both.
Oh, yeah. You can land in Prague, take off. The airport is by the city. And then go to Brno with the train, which is extremely easy.
Yeah.
And the festival is like...
It's in August.
Yeah, August. So
are you going?
I cannot go this year. I have so many things with the family here.
But next year you're going to go, so maybe I'll go when you're there.
Yeah. I'll keep in touch. I'll remind you.
Yeah.
Because that festival is so much fun. You get all these famous guitar players. You get breakfast, lunch, dinner. You get to sit next to them in a restaurant. And you talk to them.
Everybody eats together.
Everybody eats together. They reserve this restaurant for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
So you go there whenever you get up or go for lunch. And you will sit next to somebody you don't know who's going to play tonight or who's going to teach. I mean, I love it. And the city is so much fun, too, afterwards.
Yeah.
There is just a lot to do. And it's very inexpensive.
It's inexpensive, Bruno. Because no one knows. Everybody goes to Prague.
Well, the festival itself, you get the lodging, the meals 3 times a day, and the concert. And that is less than $400 in 1 week. For all that. Lodging, meals, concert.
Lodging, meals, concerts, $400.
$400 or less.
All you got to do is get there. That's not that big of a deal.
You can either land in Vienna, take the bus, which is cost like 12 euro.
Oh, man. The best would be doing a Vienna, Prague, and Brno thing.
You can land anywhere, Prague or Vienna.
It's amazing.
It is.
Let's go.
I'm so sorry I cannot go this year.
Yeah.
I have so many things I just can't leave.
I mean, so getting back to that, just the ability to go back to your country is... Well, luckily it was only 6 years. And I mean that with all due respect.
Yeah.
But I mean, some of those people, you know, were gone for 30 years.
Yes.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
And so you kind of, you know, you hit the tail end of that.
Yeah, some people,
you're
they
kind
have
of
to...
the perfect age for a communist refugee. In the sense that, like, you really, you know, like, you got out and then you were able to get right back in and see your folks before they died, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I was 25 and I went back.
How scared were you, man?
Scared, yeah. When I went back, it was amazing times. I wasn't even a citizen of the United States yet. I got my citizenship when I came back from the first visit to Czech Republic, 6 months later. So I went there on a regular passport. It was like two colors. Was the green one and the red one.
Yeah.
I had the red one. It was like a temporary only to Yugoslavia. And they let me go with that one, too. It was just a ridiculous thing.
It's just crazy.
Like an affidavit.
Well, the idea of them even being able to really get that to work.
Yeah.
It's, you're not going to be able to keep people.
Yeah.
In a place.
Anyway.
Against their will. That haven't done anything wrong.
Just can't believe that all that happened. I'm here and I see my parents. After that, I used to go sometimes twice.
They're
a
both
year.
Alive?
Yeah.
Healthy.
Alive and healthy, yeah.
What did he do? What did Dad do?
He was in the coal mining business. He was a coal mining rescuer.
And he's still alive?
Yeah.
With all that soot, all that stuff coming home all...
He was in the rescue team. He wasn't working there all day long.
Wow. Okay, good.
He was in the rescue team.
Oh, that's scary, though.
It was like a fireman.
I couldn't do that. I get claustrophobic.
And my mother worked in that factory, what I told you, with the iron factory.
Yeah, yeah, right.
She was in the lab.
Oh.
So she had a clean job, too.
Oh. So they're both scientists.
Except the pollution in the air.
She was a scientist. Yeah, exactly. A lot of that.
And there was a lot of that too, the pollution.
Yeah. Yo, really?
A lot.
Have they cleaned it up?
Well, it's in the air.
Yeah.
I'm actually glad you asked me to do this. I can sit down and talk.
Yeah, right.
I've been standing downstairs.
Working.
And tomorrow you're coming back to do...
Tomorrow I'm coming back to do an interview with...
Roberto Fabri.
And Yen as well.
And Yen too.
Yeah. Roberto. Yeah, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you know, he's been around.
He has a festival too in Rome.
Yeah, he does. Have you been to that one?
No, but I want to go in the future.
Yeah, that's the deal.
I think so.
Yeah.
Rome is great.
Rome is...
I've been there.
I have been there and I love it.
Yeah.
I love Rome. It's my favorite place in Italy.
All right. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciated it. All right, guys, that does it for the show. It's good to be back. I really appreciate you guys that hung on there and waited. I thought that was a great interview. I was happy with that one. I've got another one coming up. I think the next one we're going to do is also from the Manus Festival. That's Yen Lee, new guitarist, young up-and-comer with a brand new album out called Beautiful. So I'll be talking to her next time in a couple of weeks. All right, thanks for sticking with me, and make sure that you donate to the site if you can, if you got a heart and you got some time and you got a little bit of scratch to throw at me. Always do. It's brettwilliamsmusic.com. Donate to the right. Okay, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.